This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
I want to welcome in Marie Buskey on the program now. Hi, Marie.
Hey, Paul. How's it going?
Good. What did you make of what, because it connects with what we're just about to talk about, an interview that you have done, which is coming up. What did you think about what Stella had to say?
Oh, yeah. Look, Stella is so articulate. And she hits the points clearly and concisely. And the interview that we're about to hear very shortly is Dr. Miriam Grossman. She's a child psychiatrist. She's one of the OG identifiers of this mania. And she, you know, she's been talking and speaking out about this for 15 years. 15 years.
Lonely in the wilderness.
Very lonely in the wilderness, and she has seen it so clearly. It was really interesting what Stella said right at the very end of the interview when she talked about, even as a therapist, she would be really concerned about having her child go and see someone in therapy. And I know that's one of the concerns that Miriam has. I mean, she's one of the few psychiatrists out there that sit outside this affirmation model. The trans lobbyists have done such an incredible job at infiltrating every single corner of medicine in from the whole gender perspective. And this country is no different. In fact, we were late to the party in terms of treating, and I say treating in inverted commas, people with gender dysphoria or gender issues. And we're actually one of the last people to actually realise what's
going on. We always seem
to
be kind of out of step in that respect on many other issues as well. There's a lag time at both ends.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, absolutely.
That infiltration, that's really interesting because, and this, I think about this quite a bit, and not only in that area, the method of infiltration, it happens over quite a long period of time, probably longer time than any of us would be prepared to make an effort to do something, yet it has been so effective. I mean, how do we explain that? Is that just something that came together in a particular way, a coincidence, or was that a deployed plan almost, you know, a march?
No, this is something that has gone on since time immemorial. You know, the whole concept of someone who, in success, and they talk about, oh, they were an overnight success, but it took them 15 years to have their overnight.
Yep, I'm still
ideologies and bad ideas, and they're exactly the same. So a lot of these woke ideologies, and gender ideology comes out of the postmodernist and Marxist sort of canon.
So that's one of the significant timing events, is that?
Yes, absolutely, because that came out of academia. Now, depending on who you listen to and what school of thought that you have, that either started pre-World War II or within earnest post-World War II and has been going on quietly on university campuses through the through the 60s, then into the 70s. You know, this is a decade's worth of ideological brainwashing, training, grooming, whatever you want to call it. And these are the offsprings of these really bad ideas that get seeded, quietly fertilized, and then flourished. And what's thrown this one out, I mean, it really got some legs prior to COVID. Then COVID happened and it sort of got shuffled off to the side.
Yep.
And one of the things that certainly happened in that period of time was the element of social contagion that Stella talked about. That was one of the big changes, because up until that point, when it came to all of this gender woo-woo, it very much was male to female, and there was a strong fetish element there. What happened with the really huge rise in social media and then COVID and kids being locked down is that's when the girls really got sucked into it and the social contagion element got created.
And that's not the first time there's been a social contagion.
Oh, absolutely not. But it's the affirmation model. That's the big key difference. And Stella touched on it. Maureen will touch on it. It's when you have a model where when you go to the doctor and you don't actually sit down and discuss your issues.
Yeah, you're just there to be told. Yeah,
and you know what? When they were designing all those COVID measures, Paul, they already had a template in gender. They didn't need to reinvent the world.
Yeah.
Think about it. Going to see your GP about vaccine, that was an affirmation model, not a medical model.
That was big time affirmation. The other thing is too, because parents have to take responsibility. If you're sending your child off, you know, into a situation that could result in, well, we don't need to go through the detail, but you know what I mean.
Mm.
then you have a hand in that. And I'm just wondering if the medicalization of every problem, that's how we think, right? There's,
yeah,
we've got a problem, there's something for it, there's a person to go to. And you kind of, you know, before you try anything, you sort of drop anything that you might be able to do or any responsibility you might have and seek help, outsource the help. And people are trained to do that now.
Society, you're trained, groomed, Paul, I'd say groomed. We've been groomed to abrogate our responsibility as parents back to the state in one form or the other, whether it be medicine, whether it be education, whether it be childcare. That's what we've been taught to do. And the interview I did with Mia Hughes several months ago, and she's the co-author of the WPATH files that were leaked.
Oh, wow.
She called it the chains of trust. So as a society, our chains of trust have been built up since the 1950s, that we learn to trust these people in authority. And within authority, they have chains of trust and hierarchies. That has been obliterated in the last 5 years.
Yep.
Obliterated.
Yep, I get the word. Yep, blown to pieces.
Absolutely. And but the good thing about that as a parent is that it actually forces us not to necessarily accept what we've been groomed to accept from those in government and authority. We're actually now being forced to think critically, what is actually best for our child? What is actually best for my community? What is actually best for life at home or how we lead our lives? Instead of just instantly thinking, we will hand this responsibility over to the state and the state won't harm us.
Yeah, and you can blame someone else for the shortcomings then too. You can outsource the responsibility. Don't want to bang on about that too much. Okay, we're going to hear your interview with a child psychiatrist, Dr. Miriam Grossman, in just a moment. Any particular bit to listen out to that will jump out, or just sit back, listen to the whole thing?
Sit back and listen to the whole thing, because she gives a beautiful overview. The biggest thing, I think, really is, and when you look at the position statement that's just come out from the ministry and this now, these submissions that are now open for the consultation in terms of puberty blockers, one of the biggest things that Miriam actually covers is that there isn't actually anything here to treat from a medical point of view, from a drug point of view.
It's a mirage.
It is a mirage. She's a psychiatrist. And what she's pointing out is that most of this actually has a psychological issue that will get itself sorted out with time.
That's right. Time. Yeah. All right. Oh, and thank you, Marie,
check it out.
For doing the interview. We're going to listen to it in just a moment, and for coming on and setting it up like that. It was really good. Good. Thanks for coming on.
You're welcome, Paul. Take care. Welcome, you are with Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie, and joining me now from the United States is Dr. Miriam Grossman. Miriam is a child and adolescent psychiatrist and author of the book Lost in Transnation, a child psychiatrist's guide out of the madness. And madness it has been, Dr. Grossman, and you have been working in this space for such a long time. Welcome along, and thank you for joining us today on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great to be here, Marie. Thanks for having me.
You're most welcome. So in that 15 years that you also, that you've been working in this space, what have you seen? What has been the progression around gender ideology and the acceptance of this concept of gender amongst parents, adults, and children?
Well, I think that what most people don't understand is that gender ideology has been around for a very long time. It's been in our sex education for, at least here in the US, and I believe as well in New Zealand, for a very long time. It just was all under the radar. And what I mean by that is that kids have been taught, at least through the sort of mainstream sex education, through Planned Parenthood and other large organizations that are international organizations, they've been taught for many, many years such ideas as, gender is between the ears, sex is between the legs, they are completely divorced one from the other, and some people happen to have some incongruence between those two things, between their sex and their gender, and that is a normal variant of human development, and that when that does occur, then gender, the feeling or the internal experience of being male or female, overrides the biology. And so kids have been taught this for a very long time. I became aware of it in 2007 when I was writing a book that I called You're Teaching My Child What? And in fact, I devoted a chapter in that book to the gender issue. And people can read that chapter. They can go to my website, MiriamGrossmanMD.com. And I have there a link to that book, You're Teaching My Child What?, the chapter Genderland. And you can see there that I expressed great concern that these false and dangerous ideas were being taught to even very young kids as if they were established facts, which of course they are not. Gender is not a scientific concept. It is not something that can be measured or imaged or studied in according to the scientific method. It is an internal experience, an internal feeling. So it is completely subjective. So you're asking me what I've noticed over all these years, right? That's what you asked me. Well, you know, it's been quite a journey, and the journey right now is continuing, and it is very exciting because the gender ideology edifice is definitely coming down, at least in the United States and in many countries in Europe and Britain. It is coming down. What's coming down is this idea that children know themselves best. Children should be put in the driver's seat when it comes to treatment for their gender issues, and that essentially that people can create their own realities, that it's possible to construct your own reality, even no matter what your age, no matter what other psychiatric disorder you may be suffering from. But when you construct that reality, then the whole world is supposed to immediately accept it, including doctors, surgeons, teachers, parents, everybody. So that's what so-called gender-affirming care says. That is the prevailing model in the United States, and probably, I don't know, in New Zealand and Australia as well. Yep. And gender-affirming care calls for, like I said, immediate affirmation of a child's new identity and access without any gatekeeping, access to medical and surgical interventions that are utterly life-changing. So it's the most, in my opinion, there's no more consequential decision that a person can make in their lives than whether to live, whether, you know, than to live as someone other than who they are biologically. That is a momentous decision if it includes medicalization, because then we're getting into permanently altering the body and possible sterilization.
So this affirmation model is totally unique to this area of medicine, is it not? I mean, nowhere else in any form of pediatric medicine do you actually follow guidelines affirmed by a child.
Well, of course. I mean, there's nothing, never in medicine or mental health would we, you know, have a patient come into our office, state what, you know, what it is that's bothering them, how they understand what it is that's bothering them, what they would like, the treatment that they would like, and then just automatically rubber stamp it. That is not medicine. That's not what doctors are supposed to do. That's not what therapists are supposed to do. We listen, of course, we listen closely. We consider seriously what the patient is saying, because of course that's of eminent importance. But then you explore and you do, you know, a very deep exploration, especially in mental health, when people come to us with, you know, such an announcement, such as, you know, a perception that one is not what their body is, that they are describing essentially, you know, being dissociated from their bodies, being something other than their bodies, you know, that, you know, insisting that that is the reality, that their perception is the reality and not their bodies, that their bodies are somehow wrong. I mean, this is a very huge claim to be making, a very serious claim that, you know, you must look into it and you have to consider, why would this person be running away from who they are? Why would they, are they escaping something? Are they, you know, running away from femininity or masculinity for certain reasons? What are those reasons? Why do they believe that life as the opposite sex would be preferable? What is that all about? We have to dig. People are complicated. You see, gender-affirming care completely dismisses the idea that we have symptoms, we have, you know, whatever it may be, anxiety, depression, delusions, whatever symptom it might be, there are reasons behind it. And our job is to explore what those reasons may be. And it may take a long time. You know, gender affirming care calls for immediate rubber stamping the same day that a patient comes in. They might be referred immediately to an endocrinologist for puberty blockers or hormones. Whereas what needs to happen is for this child or teenager or adult to, you know, to have a chance to get to know them, to hear about their lives, to hear about what's going on at home and at school. Were they sexually abused? Were they molested? Have they been through some terrible trauma? Just like with any other patient that sits in front of us. So you see, gender-affirming care really is exceptional in all of medicine and mental health. But we are realizing that this is a very precarious, very dangerous way to try and help people, and that it's based on faulty research and faulty conclusions. And that is what my book explains. You mentioned before, I wrote this book, Lost in Trans. Oh, can you see it?
Yep. Here it is.
Oh, I have the background.
Lost in Transnation. Absolutely great title. One of the things that you have done, I think, and you've done this and also in previous books as well, is that you give a really good plain language guide, especially, I think, to parents. Because, I mean, I've got a parent, I'm a parent of two teenagers, and parenting is a minefield at the best of times. Being a teenager is a minefield at the best of times. And one of the things that I've learned over the years is consistency in time seems to fix a great many things, whether it be parenting or dealing with the vagrancies of teenage angst and adolescence. Surely that would be the most effective way to approach the gender question.
Well, Marie, you're right. I really wrote this book and my other books as well, having in mind regular moms and dads. The books are not written for people, you know, with a PhD who are professionals. They're specifically geared toward just, you know, regular families. And in this book in particular, my most recent book on the trans issue, I provide parents with model conversations that they can have with their children. And what I mean here is not only conversations to have if your child has already come to you and declared this new identity, that's already rather late, although I do provide that model conversation as well about reacting to that announcement, how to react, what to say, that first conversation. Well, it's really not only a first, it's the first of many conversations that needs to happen. I also provide a model conversation between a parent and a therapist or doctor. Who is quote unquote affirming the child, or who believes in this whole belief system is what I call it. And you want to sit down with them at maybe a teacher or a principal or a therapist or even a relative. And you want to present your side of the argument because chances are they've never heard it. Chances are, you know, most people, at least in the US and Canada and probably New Zealand, only have access to mainstream professional organization, medical organization, mental health organizations, and news organizations, what they're saying. And they're just regurgitating the faulty information. So I am giving parents in my book a way to have these conversations. Oh, and by the way, Marie, I want to just mention, because it might be hard, I don't know how easy it is to get my book in New Zealand, but there's a version, an audio version, that can be purchased from Amazon.
Yeah, the audio version is the one I purchased. So,
oh, good. And yeah. And actually, I did the narration on the audio version, and people really love that because I get rather passionate reading my words. So, we're talking about parents. What I do is provide parents with the conversation, model conversations, how to have the conversations. I also provide them with, and this is on my website as well, the resources, the articles that are out there that, you know, that question all of this, that provide data and professional opinions on why this approach toward gender-confused youth is not what we want to do. So it's really, what I'm trying to do is save families. Mm. What I'm trying to do is save kids. And I will say that, thank God, there's been quite a lot of success that I've experienced. And, you know, I strongly recommend for parents, no matter what the age of their kids may be, to become educated in this, on this topic, You owe it to your children, because what you need to do is very early on, before your child is exposed to the messages of these activists, and before your child hears the term sex assigned at birth, a very, very incorrect phrase, because sex is established at conception, the moment that the sperm and the egg unite. There's nothing that goes on, you know, at birth, except perhaps, you know, the recording on a piece of paper of what's being observed. It is not assigned. It is not the whim of the doctor or the midwife, which is what our kids are being told. They are being told at a very young age, when you were born, the adults in the room made a guess about whether you were a boy or girl. That guess may have been correct, or it may have been incorrect, because only you know who you are. So this is the outrageous message. This is the lie that is being told to our kids.
Well, it's a linguistic, an ideological linguistic sleight of hand, and you see it all the time. I mean, I do a lot of work with critical theory and critical race theory, and I've looked at all of them, and I know you've spoken to Professor Peter Boghossian, and he talks about this as well. And they are, it's using these often like the affirmation, you must affirm, when really, if you're breaking it down to nuts and bolts, no, you're not affirming your child. You're actually just openly telling them the lie that they want to hear.
Well, as you correctly say, yes, this is about the language. Unfortunately, the other side has been hugely successful at taking over our language. And, you know, I wish that this resistance against it had happened a long time ago, but it is finally happening now. Yes, there's many terms, many words that we're being forced to use that manipulate our thinking, and more importantly, manipulate the thinking of young people, of kids. Okay, the pronoun issue, the words like non-binary and cisgender, and this whole vocabulary that didn't exist just a short time ago, is now being completely normalized. It is not normal. We are, from the moment of conception, we are male or female. Now, people, of course, are going to bring up the intersex topic, and there are a very, very small percentage of people that are born who have medical conditions. They have chromosomal abnormalities, or they have metabolic abnormalities, and their genitalia might be inconsistent with typical male or female genitalia. However, the way that we define male and female, the way that we have always defined it, is that it is based on what type of reproductive cell your body is designed to potentially produce. There are only two types of reproductive cells, eggs and sperm. Now, does every single human being have the ability to produce viable eggs and sperm? No. There's all kinds of reasons why they may not be able to do that. That does not make them a member of a third sex. That makes them either a male or female who, for medical reasons, are unable to produce viable eggs and sperm. What the gender activists have done is that they have taken the existence of those very rare individuals and said that because they exist, that means that sex is on a spectrum, with male and female at the two extremes and many other possibilities in between those two extremes. And of course, this is what kids are being taught as well.
And Abigail Schreier's book, Irreversible Damage, she talks about the dangers of young women to this ideology. And she explores social contagion. Now, as somebody that works as a psychiatrist in the space of children, the concept of a social contagion, does this gender dysphoria for young girls fit into this category, do you believe?
100%. 100%. So a social contagion is the phenomenon of feelings or beliefs or behaviors spreading within a group of friends, a group of social contacts. And we already know in psychiatry, this it's well established that social contagion exists regarding suicidal behaviors, suicides, as well as eating disorders. And I can tell you just from my own experience with my own patients about social contagion. For example, a young woman once told me, a patient of mine, that she always had, she had dysphoria or unhappiness or discomfort with her breasts, but she never had it about her female hips. And then she was speaking with a friend of hers who was going on and on about how much she hates her hips. And then lo and behold, this patient of mine told me she also began to be preoccupied with her hips. We also have the initial blockbuster study from 2018 by Dr. Lisa Littman. And I explain all of this in my book. Dr. Littman noticed that in her small town, there were an exceptional number of teenagers, mostly girls, who were suddenly announcing that they were boys. And Dr. Lippman, an OBGYN and a researcher, was very curious to find out why a condition that in the past was only seen in one of tens of thousands or over 100,000 people, and suddenly in her small town, there was a cluster of cases. So she started to research this, and she ended up writing this really groundbreaking report in which she illustrated that due to social contagion, well, she concluded that the reason for these clusters of kids was probably social contagion. And she reported that if, according to her statistics, if a young person was in a friend group that had one or more kids who were identifying as transgender, the chance of that child beginning to identify as transgender was 70 times that of a child who didn't have any friends who identified as transgender. And we know now, for example, let me just explain. You see, if this transgender identity was not related to social contagion, then if we looked at a map, for example, of a city and all the cases of kids identifying as transgender, they would be randomly distributed. you know, one or, you know, in the middle of the city, and then some like on the outskirts of the city, and so on. But when we look at a map of these cases, we see clusters. So we see a bunch of cases all together, maybe at a given high school or a given middle school. And we also know that social contagion can occur not only in with physical, you know, people that you go to school with or that you live nearby, but online. Okay, online. And that's why in my book, I strongly, strongly urge parents to get in control of their child's internet use. I have an appendix written by an IT expert on how to do that. It is absolutely mandatory, regardless of whether your child has gender issues or not. You must be aware that the internet is full of predators and full of individuals that are only going to be too happy to make contact with your child and influence them, not only about gender, about a lot of subjects, and to, you know, instill in your child beliefs that might go against what you as a parent believe in. So that, I mean, that's a whole topic that we could spend a lot of time speaking about.
We could. I want to actually, before we go, I do want to pivot a little bit to where things are at, but I'll just let you know this one thing on that point. I have, my oldest son has got a very high functioning autism, and he, with the, but it's not just the gender stuff, but all critical theory ideologies. People with autism have a specific sort of susceptibility to them. And I saw that quite early on. And I said to my son when he was in his preteens, and we were talking about, you know, this is before he had a phone or anything like that. And we talked about, you know, how he thinks differently and is wired different. And I said to him, look, there are some ideas out there that the way that you think and process will make you more susceptible to some of these ideas, and we need to be vigilant. And we talked about social media. And to that end, he's 18 now, has no social media presence whatsoever, doesn't use social media, has no interest in social media, and he's a much happier child because, what is a young man now? He's a much happier young man because of it. Yeah, I can totally agree with that.
Good for you, Marie. Good for you.
Yeah. Now, I do want to get on to what's happened in this recent year, because there has been a tremendous breakthrough, and that breakthrough came firstly with the work of Mia Hughes and Michael Schellenberger around the leaking of the WPATH files, and then very serendipitously followed on the CAS report from Dr. Hilary Cass out of the UK, and then that also clustered with some of the work coming out of Scandinavia, especially, I think also in the Netherlands, of finally a speaking out and a speaking up of the fact that there is some very disturbing ideas based on flimsy principles and some quite shoddy practices even currently within this entire area of gender medicine. So talk me through that a little bit more.
Yeah, well, of course, some of us have been speaking out about these shoddy, dangerous ideas for a long time, but what's happened, what's new, is that medical authorities, you know, in quite a few countries in Europe, Scandinavia, Britain, of course, and in Chile as well, and they have, they have analyzed the data on gender-affirming care, and they have concluded, every one of these places, and I'm going to say Sweden, Norway, Finland, Denmark, the UK, authorities in France, medical authorities in Germany, 25 states here in the US, have all come to the same conclusion, which is that these, number one, that this diagnosis of gender dysphoria is not permanent, is in a majority of cases not permanent, and that we cannot identify in which individuals the distress is going to continue and in which individuals it will stop. We know from studies that were done in the past on children who had childhood onset gender dysphoria, that a great majority of them, depending on the study, between something like 65 and 98%, their dysphoria or unhappiness resolves with when they reach young adulthood. Something happens during puberty that, you know, the maturation of the brain, the exposure to estrogen and testosterone, you know, simply going, you know, getting older, growing up, going through more of life, all those things have an impact, no doubt. And most of these kids, the ones that were studied who had childhood onset, ended up being gay or lesbian. Now, right now, we're looking at a completely new group of kids who have gender dysphoria starting suddenly in adolescence. And what all these medical authorities all over the world and countries and 25 states in the United States have declared is that to intervene and give these kids medications and surgeries that will forever alter their bodies and possibly sterilize them is simply reckless. And furthermore, the data shows that these interventions do not provide benefit. The mental health in the long term, the mental health of these kids remains, you know, remains impaired. They continue to have mental health issues. They continue to have increased rates of suicide, although this, you know, the suicide rates are very, very small, but the interventions, the medical interventions, so-called gender-affirming care, which is, you know, called life-saving, medically necessary, it doesn't change the suicide rate in kids. So that is what's going on now. And there's been, you know, this sort of explosion. It seems like every few weeks, there's another, you know, medical authority or state here in the United States, or, you know, medical, you know, another country that is making the decision to essentially ban these treatments, you know, is being announced. So I'm finding it very, very positive, and I'm very hopeful.
Michael Schellenberger said that this has the potential to be the greatest medical scandal of the modern era. Also, you've got now the new change of administration that is about to happen. I was really disturbed seeing on X a number of surgeons, gender surgeons, boasting about how they were so busy rushing through these irreversible surgeries on these young people. That is, and then you think, I think to myself, who benefits with all of this, Miriam? Who benefits?
Okay. Well,
I know it's a Jennifer Billick question probably, but...
Oh, you had Jennifer Billick?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay. I was just going to tell you about her. Okay. Well, who benefits, you know, if you've had Jennifer, then you already know about the whole background, but certainly many people are benefiting financially. And as well, the people who would like to see humanity 2.0, a world without male and female, People may think that that's really a fringe idea, but it's gaining a lot of steam. And who benefits really are, you know, I would say that in general, the left is about pushing the envelope, tearing things down, tearing down Judeo-Christian values, tearing down, you know, everything around us, tearing down our education, tearing down the health system and ruining it in order to indoctrinate kids and recruit them into these belief systems. So those people who, you know, want for political and social reasons to transform the world as we know it, benefit from this. And it is a massive scandal. It's a massive medical scandal. But I am very hopeful with the new administration coming in. And I'm hopeful that more and more people are no longer just staying silent out of fear. Because up until now, many people, including doctors and therapists and teachers and social workers, and I have so many emails from them saying, Dr. Grossman, we totally agree with you and thank you for standing up. I cannot speak out because I will lose my job. Mm. So that is also, I think, that is going to change.
Mm. Yeah, that whole area of medical censorship is one that I don't think a lot of people in the wider world are fully aware of. And I agree. I think, and that it's on a great many levels, not just in the gender space either. Look, Dr. Grossman, this has been an utter joy. This is Dr. Miriam Grossman. Your book, of course, is called Lost in Transnation, A Child Psychiatrist's Guide Out of the Madness. As I said, I got mine in an Audible form. I'm pretty certain Amazon, we do get Amazon here, so they should be able to purchase it there. We will make sure, guys, that we will find it, pop it in the show notes for you so you'll be able to get a direct link to that.
Thank you so much, Marie. Please also put up my website, MiriamGrossmanMD.com, because there's a lot of reading material. There's many videos, including my testimony in front of Congress, in which I was refuting a gender doctor who was sitting right next to me. That's quite entertaining to watch.
Yeah, and the other thing too, I mean, having watched it, you have done an interview with Peter Boghossian, I'd seen that, and I really enjoyed the two interviews you did with Yanya Kalik at the Epoch Times. They were very, very informative, so I'd definitely suggest those as well. So thank you so much for your time today. This has been really informative, Dr. Miriam Grossman. Thank you.
Thank you, Marie.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.